Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Dandy!
I'm very glad to be talking about movies with my friends, as always.
Yes, as always. Before we get started, I'd like to discuss Rebeller's first book, They Called Me Wyatt, by Natasha Tynes. You might remember the story of Natasha Tynes, the author who lost her book deal after Twitter's outrage mobs canceled her for tweeting a photo of a Metro employee eating on a train. After she lost her book deal, Dallas Saunier, my boss, he reached out and rescued her novel from the ash heap of history. There's anything Rebeller stands for, it's saying no to the perpetually aggrieved. That flamethrower you hear at the beginning of each show is wielded by Dallas himself. It's aimed right at the heart of phony outrage. They Called Me Wyatt is now available on paperback and on Kindle at Amazon.com. You can also get it on ebook at Google. So check it out. We're big fans. We hope you will enjoy it. Now on to the show. First up in controversies and non-controversies. The job news is bad, you guys. Unemployment is up near 15%, which will come as no surprise to anyone who has paid any attention to the movie industry, where all production is shut down and virtually all theaters are closed, where agencies are firing support staff and shedding agents, and where TV networks are bleeding advertisers. Despite the fact that the coronavirus is far from defeated, people are desperate to get back to theaters and other entertainments. Tenet, the Christopher Nolan movie, it's still set for July 17th, its release date. Nolan is holding on fast to it despite reported studio trepidation. San Antonio area theaters opened last weekend to modest crowds. Shanghai Disney sold out its first day of tickets immediately. And drive-ins flourish anywhere the government has decided to allow them to open. And every government should allow all of them to reopen because it's stupid not to have them open. But I worry that we are headed toward what my former colleague, Matt Continetti, refers to as the cruel new normal, one in which we struggle to reopen and get people back on their feet so they can work and so they can feed their families and so they can feel useful, even as 1,500 people or so just every day are dying in the background. Alyssa, is the cruel new normal what we are headed toward? Or will Christopher Nolan save us?
I mean, I would love Christopher Nolan to save us, not least because I really, really, really want to see Tenet. But I don't know, man. I have been experiencing a lot of anxiety and rage this week about the fact that we seem to have just stalled out with 1,500 to 3,000 Americans dying a day, and that the sacrifices that we all made in shutting down movie theaters and everything else appear to have been for not very much, in the sense that the federal government has not gotten it together to do any of the things that would restore confidence and allow people to go back to their normal lives. I mean, I am desperate to see this movie. I am desperate to see pretty much any movie. At the same time, I have no idea how I would go to a theater and not just be unbelievably consumed with anxiety the entire time. I have no idea how the thing that would be my escape would feel like an escape at all anymore. And so I am simultaneously hopeful and completely full of dread. Woohoo!
Yay! That sounds like the new normal, all right. Peter, what are your thoughts?
In some ways, this is up to the public, and it's really not clear where they are going to fall on this question. I think it's, or at least it's not clear where they're going to be in July. We've talked about the lockdowns and the closures in many ways as a function of government shutdowns, and that's completely valid and totally real to some extent. But if you see currently the states that are reopening, people aren't going back out to restaurants for the most part. People aren't going to theaters. People are scared to go back out. And you see this consistently reflected in the polls. You have large numbers of people say they wouldn't do things like go to a sporting event, like go to a movie theater, like go to a restaurant or a bar. More people say they would do things like, say, go to dinner in a friend's home. But it's going to take a while, regardless of what happens with the legal environment here, for people to become comfortable. And it's not clear exactly what it's going to take to get people to become comfortable. I don't think, one of the things we've seen is that business owners, including movie theaters, are talking about They kind of understand this. They understand that it's their job to make viewers comfortable and not, as Alyssa said, extremely anxious. But it's almost impossible to imagine what a movie theater could do to make certainly people who are a little bit higher anxiety, who live in dense urban areas where, in fact, a lot of movie tickets are sold, which are sort of crucial markets for big films. It's really difficult to imagine what they could do, at least right now, and maybe even through the summer, to make enough people comfortable for this to be worth it. Now, one thing they can do, or at least they could try to do, I think, is release a big movie. And that's not going to make people necessarily psychologically comfortable with the idea of being in a crowd, but it's going to give them an incentive, something they want to come out to.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they end up releasing Tenet and Mulan in July, if that ends up happening and people go see those movies in maybe not the numbers that they would have seen, but in large enough numbers, that might do something to ease public concerns if the health picture doesn't deteriorate.
But it's
a little bit of a chicken and an egg problem where people aren't going to be comfortable until they see that it's okay to go out, but they can't. The way they see that it's okay to go out is by seeing that people are going out and that it's working out.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's a signal, right? It's a signal in confidence that we'll be able to do this thing and theaters will be able to reopen. And this is there. You know, there's a big piece in Variety a couple of days ago basically saying like Christopher Nolan wants to save movie theaters. This was the crux of the piece, that he is such a believer in the theatrical ideal that, you know, he has this weekend in July that has worked for him throughout his whole career, right?
Interstellar. Interstellar was a late year release. I believe a November release.
Right. It was okay. Fine. But he often releases these big blockbuster type movies in the last couple of weeks of July and has done very well with them. And
going back to Batman Begins. I mean, that was a late July
and
film,
he,
as I recall.
He sees himself as, I think, a sort of savior of movies. And I have to say, I get it. I totally get it, because if he, the big theater guy, says, you know what, we can't do it. We can't do it in theaters. It's not safe. People won't come. It's not financially responsible. Then theaters are screwed. I think there's a real logic to that. And I think that, you know, it's hard to weigh these things, benefits of, you know, health and commerce and all that. But I really admire the fact that he is trying to do this through almost sheer force of will, to say to the studios, if you want me to work with you, you have to back me on this.
I do think there's an additional time-based problem here, which is that studios kind of have to make this decision somewhere between at least 6 and really more like 10 to 12 weeks in advance, because they have to decide whether they're going to do their marketing spend. And the marketing spend on a $200 million Christopher Nolan film is at least a couple hundred million dollars, and they don't want to start spending that 10
cheaper
weeks in
now.
Advance. But they don't want
to
start spending that money.
It's also easier
2 months
to raise
in advance and then
now.
Not release the film. And
yeah.
I think they are, they're very anxious about this.
What we're saying is that across the movie aisle, we'll give Christopher Nolan a fantastic deal on Tenet advertising.
Yeah, it's true.
I think that's what this segment is right now.
Syncope.
Is we all want to see Tenet, right? Like,
yes.
Literally, it's the only thing that is keeping me going, from spiraling into full on existential despair. This is like a weird little personal thing, but like that late July weekend lines up very frequently with my birthday. So it's always like Christopher Nolan, you know, when he has a new movie out, it's like he's giving me a present and it makes me feel so happy inside.
That's
and
when Once Upon a present, Time in Hollywood came out last year, right? It's a good weekend.
Right?
It's the smart summer weekend.
It's when
auteurist directors who get to spend lots of money making actually interesting films get to release their films either the second, third, one of those late weekends in July.
But Alyssa, I what would make you feel comfortable going back to the movie theaters? Because I do think there's something to be said for having theaters open and playing stuff that people don't really want to see, so the theaters themselves can get ready
Yeah.
Essentially, and so they can prepare themselves.
And look, it's hard because, like, everything about this, it's not an individual decision. I don't live by myself in a studio apartment and have no contact with other people. I have a husband. I have a kid. I have childcare and another family that is in on that childcare with us. And I can't make a decision about exposing myself to a bunch of random people on my own and with solely my own interests in mind. And that's the challenge of this pandemic in general, right? We need to rebuild collective trust. And there are a bunch of people who have just completely just given up on that responsibility. And so it's really hard. I mean, you know, we have masks. We wear them whenever we go out of the house. You know, I think if movie theaters were handing out masks, maybe fogging theaters in between screenings, like if they could tell me a lot about their disinfection protocol, I'd probably be more comfortable in a theater that wasn't selling concessions, honestly, just because, like, people are going to take their masks off to eat candy and soda. And I love me some refrigerated Thin Mints, but not enough to die of a respiratory illness for
them. But that just sort of points to the scale of the economic problem here, because if you cut out half the revenue from the tickets, say, you know, by saying we're only going to sell 50% or even 30% of the seats.
And then the crazily upsold concessions. Yeah, no, it's
the movie theaters make
problem.
Their money off of popcorn sales, off of Thin Mints, right? Off of, or not Thin Mints, but Junior Mints. That's the Girl Scouts. They're related, but not the same. In fact, I pulled up the chart that the New York Times printed about what people would be willing to do. And the question is, if restrictions were lifted on the advice of public health officials. So it's not
which they are not being at the moment.
To be clear, the public health officials are not saying that it's okay to go to the movies right now. But even if they were, 61% of people say they definitely or probably would not go to the movies. It is only after going to a stadium concert is it the thing that most people are likely to say they would not do. Even if public health officials said it was okay to open these things and it was okay to go.
And look, I want to go back so badly. I miss it. It's not just Christopher Nolan thinking about sort of the beauty and purity of seeing this stuff well projected on a big screen in an ideal environment with well-calibrated sound. You know, I was interviewing a writer for a project I'm working on now, and she said, you know, she was really hoping that we'd see a comedy come back. But once things are back to semi-normal, because there's just something so cathartic about laughing at a joke with other people and seeing what you have in common. And that's not true just for comedy, right? It's, you know, everyone jumping at a jump scare in a horror movie or cheering when our heroes pull off something unexpected and awesome in an action movie. Movies have their own role to play in restoring public trust and a sense of common human experience, but we can't get there without other measures of trust being restored. And, you know, theaters pose particular challenges, but the real challenges are the ones that everyone else is not stepping up to meet, and it's crushing.
I'll tell you what I worry about. Sonny, you described Nolan as the savior of cinema, you know, sort of this as a guy who has positioned himself as the man who thinks that cinema, traditional cinema, right, on film, the theatrical experience, not just the theatrical experience, but the particular methods of projection are very important. And someone who realizes that he has a major role to play here and needs to step in and sort of try to make this happen, I worry that if, for whatever reason, Tenet gets delayed, pulled from the release schedule, that's it. That if, you know, that becomes a kind of a death knell, because if Christopher Nolan can't do it, then who can? Yeah. Then when will be able to? If there's a vaccine, if there's a major change in the public health environment, maybe that fixes things. But 2 years from now or 18 months from now, who knows whether those theaters will, I mean, all of which are deep in debt, all of which have borrowed a ton of money. We talked about this before. Part of it is just that if you don't start bringing revenue to movie theaters, meaningful revenue from new blockbuster releases pretty soon, and that doesn't necessarily mean July, but it means sooner rather than later, the spaces that we show movies in and that people go to see movies in just won't exist anymore, or they won't exist in the form that that they exist now.
There's a version of this movie where the end of Act One is a headline in a newspaper that says Christopher Nolan pulls Tenet from calendar, citing health concerns. And then we flash forward basically 3 years later, and we open on an AMC Amazon or a Regal Disney, and a family is like walking through the Disney gift shop on the way to go see the live action Fox and the Hound, right? Like that's like what there's a very real possibility that if this summer is lost entirely, which would probably lead to the fall being lost entirely and probably Oscar season being lost entirely, that it just is unsalvageable in its current form. Maybe it's unsalvageable in its current form anyway. I don't know.
The one thing I would say is that the one thing that I think the theatrical experience has going for it is that every other sector that involves commercial real estate is in just as much trouble. And the malls and shopping centers and developments like the one in Chinatown in DC are going to have a horrible time filling those spaces. And so we'll be at some point just incentivized to give movie theaters a break. Because it's not like, I mean, those are difficult spaces to reconfigure. It's a lot of space to reconfigure. And, finding someone else to fill that is going to be a bear. So movie theaters are going to have at least some leverage in terms of working out those particular finances. And, look, I don't think the movies are gone forever. I think they may be different. I think that we are likely to see some corporate consolidation, not just because of the pandemic, but because of the legal environment that's been changing around theaters. Although maybe, Joe Biden can still promise to keep the Paramount decrees in place and save movies going culture forever. Christopher Nolan should just go back and forth to both campaigns and like negotiate over the Paramount decrees and then issue his endorsement. I think it's going to be bad. I think it's going to be hard. I think it's going to be bad and hard in every aspect of life for a long time. But I don't think it's going to be over forever.
Yay. Hope. Ugh. I don't even have a question to end this segment, so I'm just going to move on to something really uplifting. Our main attraction, Arkansas. Written and directed by Clark Duke, who is best known for his comedic sidekick roles on shows like The Office and movies like Kick-Ass, Arkansas is a very different beast and one that defies easy definition. It's part black comedy, part crime thriller, part languid southern slice of life. It stars Liam Hemsworth as Kyle and Duke as Swin, a pair of low-level drug runners who run into trouble under the tutelage of a park ranger named Bright, who is played by John Malkovich. The man hovering over all of this action is Frog, a Dixie Mafia bigwig unknown to basically everyone except us and one or two other characters. He's played by Vince Vaughn in another of his late career pseudo-heavy roles. But to say he's the villain here is not quite right. I found Arkansas to be interesting for the way in which it depicts life as something we just kind of slide into. One day you wake up and you're a drug dealer, and then you're a murderer. And then you're a drug kingpin who murders people. It's not really a planned route. It's just life. And it's applicable all over. Not just to the drug dealers among us like Peter Suderman. But also, it's not like I grew up and I decided to become a podcasting magnate with fingers in many different shows, pulling the strings from behind the scenes. I just fell into this degraded, despicable life. Arkansas is definitely slowly paced. Its structure is a little bit strange. It hops back and forth between the 1980s and something approaching the present. That's never made entirely clear what time the quote-unquote present sections are in. But it has an episodic, chapter-like feel to it.
There are literally chapters in the film. Literally it's broken up into named chapters.
Yeah, this worked for me. I get the sense it didn't for you guys. It worked for me because it shows Vaughn and Hemsworth both kind of doing this thing where they slide into their life of crime. But judging by our text messages, I am the only one who cared for this movie in any way whatsoever. Peter, what would you have done with the 2 hours this movie cruelly stole from your life? Would you have perfected a new tiki cocktail, for instance?
So, first of all, you're damn right. I'm a drug dealer. I get high on life, and that is the high that I sell to everyone else. This movie, I didn't love it. I think it has some real flaws, but I don't think it's in some ways, it's not completely awful. Right? There's a lot. So it's not just.
Ways, it's
not that I disliked
on the poster.
It. In fact, there's a bunch of stuff that I liked about it. And the main thing that I liked about it is Vince Vaughn. And the Vince Vaughn segments aren't without flaw, but I think they just work much, much better than the other segments. And the reason is that Vince Vaughn is just a really interesting character actor. And his late career transformation is really something to behold. You think about his debut and sort of when he came on the scene as the loud talking guy in Swingers. He kind of famously wrote all of his own lines in that film. That was not exactly Vince Vaughn's personality, but it was an extension of Vince Vaughn himself. And he then developed that character for a bunch of years, played it in a bunch of different movies, even things like, big films like Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And in later years, he has become something else, something sort of quieter and weirder and darker and more contemplative without just being completely subsumed by, by grittiness. And watching those sequences, which again, I don't think they were flawless, but they were much more interesting. And whenever he came on screen, I felt like the movie really got much more interesting. Yeah. It just made me want to see, first of all, I wanted to see this whole movie from his perspective. And I wanted the whole thing to be about Frog and about Vince Vaughn and having to deal with these two kind of weirdos who just showed up in his life. Who were dragged into his life by John Malkovich, who, what the hell is John Malkovich doing in this movie?
Can I interject here and ask Alyssa a question? Because what strikes me, this film's big problem strikes me as Liam Hemsworth.
Yes.
Who is something of a charisma black hole. And I like him in some other stuff. I think he's okay as a bit player, but here he's kind of positioned to be the main character. The movie starts with his narration and it ends with his narration, and he is like the kind of driving force through the first parts of it. But Alyssa, I mean,
he's a driving force, but not just with no charisma. Very too little. He does too little in the film, and the film underwrites his character.
That actually works for me. That actually works for me because again, this movie is about how you slide into weird situations and it becomes your life. Alyssa, I as the token woman in the, on the show, I understand Liam Hemsworth's many appeals, but here he just is just a black space on the screen, kind of absorbing light and not reflecting anything back.
Well, thank you for soliciting opinion from
there
little old
go.
Me. this movie is simultaneously sort of interestingly laid back and like very precious. It's sort of a twee Southern drug dealer movie in a way that's just weird and off-putting. I mean, Liam Hemsworth is a lesser Hemsworth. I think we can all agree on that. For me, the whole thing, I mean, there are many things I disliked about this movie. I disliked the amount of stabbing. I disliked the amount of eye damage. I disliked the whole just like random romantic comedy subplot that doesn't work at all. I don't mind John Malkovich in this movie, in part because in a weird way it's a throwback to his performance in Deepwater Horizon, where in both cases he's playing like slightly effeminate but very competent sort of weird Southern types in a way that I think sort of works. But yeah, it's just, I mean, it's a movie that tonally makes no sense. It's about the wrong characters. It cuts the wrong things. Any movie that casts Michael K. Williams and then like gets rid of him early in the movie to make space for like a pair of Boulder-like but otherwise completely anonymous like Southern Crab and Goyle twins. Just like what was anyone involved in this thinking? Like every
they make
decision.
Donuts. Don't you get it? It's a metaphor.
No, they don't make donuts. There aren't any donuts available.
See,
I mean, it's
a metaphor.
Oh God, I mean, just. Every choice in this movie is wrong, except for casting Vince Vaughn.
Yeah, it's a movie that I like. Often found myself thinking, like, why are we here? Why are we watching this?
You
why
know,
is this happening?
You know
on
why
screen?
We're here and watching this? Because you made us.
No. I don't mean why are we here watching this? Because that is the life we have chosen, Alyssa. This is the life we have chosen. They can't all be Avengers Endgame or whatever. You know, sometimes the movies have to be. I can't. Is that the one you liked or the one you didn't like? I can't remember. Did you like either of those, Infinity War or Endgame?
No.
Yeah, you hated both, right? Damn.
Endgame was the good one.
No, they were both bad. What I meant is, like, why is the movie here? Why are we doing this? And some things actually snap into place when you realize that Clark Duke wrote this and he directed it in part to, like, try to unstereotype himself as the comic sidekick. So this is why he has that random rom-com subplot. In any other version of this movie, she is probably with Liam Hemsworth, right?
She's definitely with Liam Hemsworth. Like,
exactly. So, like, once you realize, like, okay, he has kind of written a lot of this in a way. And this is, again, why I think the Vince Vaughn stuff works so much better, is because Clark Duke Swin is nowhere near it. Like, he has nothing to do there. I don't know.
But it's also, I mean, it is tiresomely self-indulgent, right? It's like, I'm like the short weirdo and I'm going to get with the super hot nurse for like no reason, despite the fact that I'm incompetent and off-putting and just what? I mean, yeah,
See, this is why we need your perspective.
Most relationships, as far as I can tell, are built on stalking women in grocery stores. Like, that's the foundation of a good, you know, parental.
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure situation. I see what the problem is here.
So I will tell you, that is not how I met my husband.
Well, you know, we can't all be perfect like Swin. I don't know. It's definitely a movie that, like, if it wasn't for the fact that there is nothing in theaters, and frankly, we're all just kind of looking for something to do and for something to watch, would have probably popped up and been an oddity and would have, like, very vocal and vociferous champions, but wouldn't be subjected to, like, blockbuster scrutiny, which I think is what this will end up getting, you know, to a certain extent. And this is not a movie you open on 3,000 screens, and putting this on VOD now is essentially the equivalent of opening it on 3,000 screens, right? Because it's the only thing.
I will note that it is priced rather differently than some of the other things that have come to VOD recently.
Yes. Yes, you can definitely buy this for $10. It's not a $20 rental. It is a more traditional VOD release, yeah. Shall we say. I don't know. I'm at least glad that you guys liked Vince Vaughn in it, because I liked Vince Vaughn a lot. I thought he was very good.
It makes me want, like, Quentin Tarantino to write a Vince Vaughn movie. It makes me want somebody who has a really good character writer to write a Vince Vaughn film. You know, P.T. Anderson, something like that. It makes me want to see Vince Vaughn in a Coen Brothers movie. And I think this movie is in some ways really indebted to.
I got a little movie for you called Brawl in Cellblock 99,
which is great. Which is a wonderful movie. But I still think. You know, I want to see it's a wonderful movie, and it's not something, you know, it's not a film that is going to have a really big mainstream appeal just because of the violence. And I think, you know, as much as I like it and also you know, liked him a lot in Dragged Across Concrete, it seems like there's a Vince Vaughn moment that could happen. In which suddenly people come back and see, wait, this guy actually really kind of can command a screen in an interesting way. But he needs one of those great writer, director, you know, character filmmakers.
You know, I want him to be I want him and Oscar Isaac to be together in either an Alex Garland movie or a J.C. Chandor movie.
Yeah, J.C. Right, Chandor could write a Vince Vaughn film, I think.
Right, of, like the Vince Vaughn equivalent of, like, Most Dangerous Year is. Like,
yeah.
Also, have we talked about how great A Most Violent Year is? That movie is fantastic. I'll make you guys watch it in a couple weeks. It's
we've so talked good. About that. We've discussed that in person before, maybe not on the show.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Well, thumbs up or thumbs down on Arkansas?
There are better ways to spend your $6.99, especially in the worst economic conditions since the Great Depression. Thumbs down.
Unfortunately, I have to give it a thumbs down, except for Vince Vaughn completists. If you're a Vince Vaughn completist, frankly, you can just watch the Vince Vaughn sections and enjoy those. And the movie tells a nearly complete little miniature story about this guy who calls himself Frog, who just sort of finds himself as a Southern drug kingpin. I won't say it's great, but it's actually pretty good and charming and weird in ways that are worth watching.
I will give it a thumbs up, but kind of a tentative thumbs up. Again, very much on the strength of Mr. Vince Vaughn. All right, on to assigned viewing. Up this week is The Death of Stalin, which I have assigned in part to honor May Day, very important holiday. The Death of Stalin is Armando Iannucci's pitch black satire of life under Stalin, a look at the ways in which ultimate power residing in a single person warps not only justice, but reality itself. People really do believe whatever they have to believe to survive. It's also just like the funniest movie I've seen in a long time. I was watching it again last night to prep for the show, and it just has all of these great little throwaway one-liners that feel improvised, but you know they're not improvised because Iannucci does not really do a lot of improvisation on set. Just like there's this one moment very early on where Malenkov, who's played by Jeffrey Tambor, mentions somebody who has been disappeared to the gulag, and everybody like freezes up and tenses in silence, and Stalin himself is like, "You want to go visit him where he is?" And the other guys who are there, one who's played by Steve Buscemi, who plays Khrushchev, and Beria, Lav Beria, who was played by a British actor I can't remember the name of, start kind of sing-songing to him after Stalin is out of earshot, like, "Oh, what about Trotsky? Oh, what? Let's bring back the Tsar," you know? And it's just this, like, it's this hilarious slice of what it is like to live with death hanging over you all of the time. And in theory, that wouldn't be funny, but it is. It is actually hilarious, especially Jason Isaacs playing Grand Marshal Zhukov, or whatever his rank is, as this bro-y jock who is just out there, you know, swaggering around and throwing his weight around. That's the best thing I have seen in a comedy in like 5 years. Yeah. As somebody on Twitter put it, this movie has like the deepest bench of talent of any comedy in the last 10 years. And Jason Isaacs, of all people, like walks into it and just steals the show in like 30 seconds. Like the moment he shrugs that jacket off his shoulders, the movie is his.
Well, in the scene where Khrushchev approaches him about going along with this coup against Beria, and he gets very serious about how he's gonna have to report him, and then pulls a total like 20th century bro, "I'm just messing with you, man, look at your face." it's amazing, right? And it's part of the humor comes from the fact of just how insanely inappropriate the joke is to the circumstances, right? I mean, you know, I don't know if either of you has read The Black Book of Communism. If not, and you're looking to be, you know, convinced that there are historical circumstances that are much worse than the ones that we're presently in, I highly recommend it. But, you know, Beria is an all-time scary, bad, horrible person. And so the fact that Jason Isaacs is just like, you know, messing with Khrushchev over a matter this lethal is, it should be grotesquely offensive. And instead it's hilarious. I mean, as is the early scene with Beria just like giving instructions about who to purge and under what conditions. I mean, it's, you know, shoot him first, but make sure she sees it, you know, do this person. And I just leave that one up to you. It's so dark and funny. It's just, I mean, line for line for line, it is amazingly cathartic to watch.
Peter.
Yeah.
Did you like The Death of Stalin?
What stuck out? So this, you know, I like Stalin being dead, and I like this movie a lot. And what sticks out to me again, the second time watching it, is how the movie manages to there's something almost courageous about its willingness to make these moral monsters not monstrous exactly, not in the sort of traditional sense. They're not big, bad, scheming movie villains. Instead, they're ridiculous. They're not just ridiculous. They're pathetic. And there's something I think really kind of morally powerful about portraying them as not as these sort of like, grand historical figures who are I mean, they are incredible. Like on the one hand, they're deeply evil people, but they're also just incredibly pathetic, weak little nits who are obsessed with the tiniest little things, that these incredibly minor slights to themselves, and also just jackasses, all of them. And the movie manages to draw kind of a moral power and authority, not from saying these people are incredibly scary, in the traditional movie villain kind of way, not from portraying them as kind of powerful monsters, but instead from portraying them as weak and small, and that their murderousness and their evil comes from their weakness and their smallness. And manages to be quite funny. You would think that there's this real tension between making something like this quite funny, and also not, and also making it a fierce moral criticism of Stalin's regime and the communist, regimes that followed it. But in fact, the movie manages to sort of say that, no, it's because these people are so ridiculous and so pathetic and so such worthless little pieces of shit, every single one of them. That's what made them awful. And that's what that's the source of like real evil in the world, is not, they're not supervillains. They're not Thanos, right? They're something much smaller and human, more human. And
you say there's something
worse,
something banal about them.
Kind of banal, but not just that. And the other thing, though, that I like about this is the way that it shows how Stalin's regime infected every single aspect of life, destroyed all the little things that you love, right? And not just the big things, right? It wasn't just that the movie doesn't, exactly create an equivalence between killing hundreds or thousands of people and destroying a night at the orchestra. At the same time, it says it left them nothing. It left people absolutely no place that they could be safe and that they could have some sense of beauty and joy and comfort in the world.
It looks at the regime on so many different levels, right? I mean, that opening scene with Paddy Considine, who I love as an actor. I mean, I just think he's so funny and melancholy and used to particularly good effect in Edgar Wright's movies, but also here, that debate over when 17 minutes begins, right? And it's this, it's the tiniest thing, but even that is uncertain in a really profound way. Then you also have...
Their lives are on the line thanks to some asshole's whim, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
And like, right, it's there's no escape from the evilness, the pathetic, personal, whimsy evil of Stalin and his lieutenants.
But you also see, for example, how damaged his kids are, right? I mean, Jason Isaacs is not someone you think of as incredibly funny, but neither is Rupert Friend, who is hilarious as Vasily. But again, is sort of, he's someone who has not, that we see in the movie, sort of lived in fear. Although, I mean, even with the debate over the hockey team and the plane crash. But, who has been like totally indulged.
Which is incredible, right? I mean, that whole bit about how on the one hand they have to make a plan and like figure out what to do about the fact that the plane crashed and the team died while simultaneously not in any way acknowledging that the plane crashed and the team died. And they're like, why aren't you fucking fixing this problem? And then, which of course always results in the follow-up question, what? There's a problem? There could not be a problem.
Right, but I mean, yeah. He's someone who's been, again, like indulged, not sort of lived in this constant fear, and is a total just wreck of a human being. I mean, if there's anyone who comes across, other than the pianist, Stalin's daughter comes across as this, like, someone who has, she's a product of the system, but she acts like a human being should act in these circumstances, right? I mean, she's upset that her father is sick. She's furious that the doctors seem incompetent. She is frightened of being exiled. She, sort of holds out some hope that this person she cared about might still be alive. But she's sort of the one person in the movie who for a lot of it, behaves fairly normally. And there's actually a very interesting biography of the real Svetlana, who ended up, you know, sort of living this life of exile, including in the United States. And, you know, there is... The book doesn't, and neither does the movie, suggest that she came through this sort of normally in any way. But to sort of make it out of a system like that functional at all is its own kind of small human accomplishment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's about it for the show. It's a quick one. Quick one today.
Communism is bad, guys.
Communism is bad. Oh, that is, you know, that's really good. I just wanted to throw that out there, that this is one of the few communism is bad movies. There have been, like, relative, like, compared certainly to Nazism, there have been relatively few of these, and a lot of the times when you see them, like, for instance, Bernardo Bertolucci's The Last Emperor, the lesson isn't really that communism is bad. It's that communism can be good, actually, kind of. I mean, The Last Emperor is a whole different kettle of fish that we can discuss at some time.
Yeah, and again, that's what I was find to be part of what I was talking about with its kind of moral authority, right? Like, this is not a movie that sort of tries to say, well, there were some good aspects, it got corrupted. This is a movie about how the corruption was inherent to it, not just corruption, about how the deep evil was inherent to it. And in that way, I think it sort of makes the most forceful moral case against communism that I can think of in a any piece of pop culture in the last certainly 10 years. And the only thing that kind of comes close is the movie Cold War, which is great, a very different kind of film, you know, and talks about the ways that communism just sort of corrupted personal relationships and destroyed beauty and art in the world. And, to some extent as well. But I think
The Lives of Others.
Yeah, maybe The Lives of Others. Although, isn't that a little more than 10 years old at this point?
It's old. But, I mean, that's the thing, though, right? Is that, like, basically once every 10 years you get a great movie about how communism under the Soviet regime was awful.
Well, and to a certain extent, I mean, that's a reflection of how historical memory has worked, right? I mean, the Nazi atrocities, and in particular the Holocaust, have been incredibly well documented. And, I mean, I think completely justly become part of our sort of national historical and moral educational curriculum, because Stalin was on the side of the United States, it has become less convenient to talk about the atrocities that were perpetrated under his rule. And also, frankly, when the Iron Curtain came down, people didn't see what was happening behind it for a long time. The evidence has taken longer to emerge. And in some ways, I mean, the number of people who died, you know, in Soviet-controlled Poland and Ukraine is horrifying, but lacks the sort of, you know, narrative frame of the Holocaust to explain it in some of the same ways. And I think that if Hollywood is grappling with this, it's because Americans as a whole don't entirely understand what happened in Soviet Russia.
Well, and as Hail Caesar reminds us, right, one of the reasons for that is that communist stooges were infested all throughout the Hollywood system.
But
Hail
anyone? But it's a problem with broad-based historical memory, too. So,
okay, great. Assigned Viewing next week is Spirited Away, which is available to rent on Amazon. We'll watch that. Alyssa has chosen Spirited Away for our next film. It's not quite as dark as Death of Stalin, but pretty close, frankly. All right, that's it. That is it for today's show. Make sure to check out They Called Me Wyatt by Natasha Tynes, available at Amazon.com. Please go to RebellerMedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. Just click on that little box at the top of the homepage. If you love the show, tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow a podcast audience, and if we don't grow, we'll die. We're kind of like sharks that way. And review us at Apple. If you don't love today's episode, please complain to me personally on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman, produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sanye. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamir. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.